It's Friday morning, 8 a.m., and that means it's time for the Week in Review. Two perspectives on the top state and national news stories, mostly from the world of politics. I'm Rob Ferret. I'm filling in this morning for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining me today, John Smart and Keen Winters. John Smart is chair of the Price County Democratic Party. He's a board member for the Wisconsin Alliance for Excellent Schools, and he also serves on the board of the United Nations Association of Wisconsin. He joins us by phone. John Smart, good morning.
Good morning, Rob, and congratulations on your new position at the mic there.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And joining us from our studios in Wausau, Keen Winters, financial planner in Schofield and coordinator of the Center-Right Coalition of Wausau. Keen Winters, good morning.
Hello from Wausau, Rob.
All right. Glad you could be here as well. Well, let's dive right in. I think the top story in the state this week is the issue of job numbers and their influence on the recall election. Before I ask for your take on these issues, John and Keen, I will ask our listeners to join in, get in right away, because we move from issue to issue rather quickly. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or join us on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Well, here's the deal. Job numbers are going up in Wisconsin, or they're going down. Depends on which numbers and which candidate. Governor Walker, his office released quarterly job report numbers that showed Wisconsin gained about 25,000 jobs last year. His critics are focusing on these monthly job numbers that have showed some months of job losses, disputes back and forth about which number we should stick with, which is more accurate. Keen Winters, let's start with you. What do you make of jobs as political football in Wisconsin?
Well, they are good theater, and I think both candidates on both sides exaggerate how much influence that they have in actually creating jobs. That being said, the monthly job numbers are, in fact, the most volatile, are frequently revised later, and in ways that are, it can be plus 10,000 this month, and the revision is minus 10,000. It's considerably variable. The quarterly job numbers are based on a larger sampling. They're much better. So the sense that I think the truth is in general, jobs have gone up. I also think the truth is jobs have not gone up as much as they can go up in Wisconsin because of the recall mess. It really is turning people off and causing people to hesitate either coming here or expanding.
John Smart, we'll take up that last thread that Keen Winters mentioned in a moment. But first of all, John, your take on the dueling job numbers.
I think it's very interesting that when the job numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics came out and showed Wisconsin not doing as well as they were all proclaiming, that Scott Walker and his folks all found another way of measuring. And even though 49 states in the union all use the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Scott Walker decided to find another way of counting it. And as is mostly the case, whenever you are talking about statistics, you can usually find statistics or a poll to agree with whatever it is you're trying to get across. So I think that's what we're dealing with here.
Well, looking at the data that we have, as best as you can figure out, do you think Wisconsin's moving in a good direction when it comes to jobs, John Smart?
No, I don't. I mean, the fact that we were 50th in the nation in jobs creation should say something to somebody, whether you believe the figures or not. Obviously, we're not doing as well as we could, and especially with a governor who promised 250,000 new jobs in his first term. He's not doing so well, is he?
Well, what do you think, Keen? Even if we are seeing some positive growth, is it enough?
It is not enough. And I think it is an interesting sort of turn of events, because I really think the recall process has caused the jobs not to be as strong as they should be. But I do believe they're growing. I'll give you an example. I was reading The Economist magazine last week, and I flipped through to a one-page ad from the state of Indiana hawking business to come to Indiana, and their selling points were low taxes, stable government, right-to-work state, centrally located. Now, I think two of those are aimed squarely at us, and if you don't think that the recall process is tamping down jobs, everybody in Wisconsin is paying a price for this foolishness, for going outside the regular electoral process and creating an unstable situation, unstable situations just are not good for business.
So, John Smart, businesses don't know who's going to be governor next month. They don't know if we're going to see rapid and volatile policy changes soon after that. Do you buy that? Do you think that's keeping jobs from being created in Wisconsin?
Oh, like most excuses, I imagine there's a bit of truth in it someplace, but it is an excuse. And it didn't start out this way, remember. It started out with him promising 250,000 jobs and then throwing in that legislation that threw the wrench in the works. So, yeah, I suppose there's something to that. Everybody in the country is watching Wisconsin right now to see what's going to happen here. And there are other states that I think are kind of wondering what's happening here, too, because they're not sure if they want to go the same route that we are.
Well, now, how much of this is beyond our control? I mean, however we read these numbers, they're okay, maybe not great. But the national economy, the recovery such as it is, isn't going gangbusters. Is a lot of this out of the control of us here in Wisconsin, starting with Keene?
Absolutely. I mean, we do tag on the national numbers. We had a presentation by Todd Berry, and he really says we in fact lead the national numbers, and that's sort of a historic trend. And so there are questions about whether Wisconsin, which is typically a leading indicator, is an indicator that things are softer out there in the national economy than we think.
John?
I think that the economy is improving nationally, and it's not as fast as anybody would like, of course, but it is definitely improving. And again, if you look at the figures for all 50 states, the one that Wisconsin's on the bottom of, there are some states that are developing very quickly. And on a national level, yes, it's improving. It's, as I say, not as fast as we would like, but it was a hole that we were in. It was a serious hole that we were in, and we're not going to crawl out of it very quickly. That's a fact.
To the phones we go now. Dave in Wanakee wants to weigh in on the issue. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, about that jobs report that Scott Walker put out, the competing one, they also took a look at his college transcripts at Marquette and found out he graduated summa cum laude with a master's. And then they looked at the county budget when he was the Milwaukee County executive, and he found every year they had a surplus, and he gave everyone a tax cut.
Gotcha, Dave. Sarcasm doesn't always play that well on talk radio, but the gist there is, I think, he doesn't buy the numbers that Governor Walker is talking about this week. Keene Winters?
Well, in some sense I agree with John that you can find statistics to back up whatever. I think in initially, you know, Governor Walker made the $250,000 job promise, and so he elevated that issue to a level that's probably unrealistic. But I would disagree with John's sort of characterization that Walker sort of cherry-picked or brought out these numbers. This is part of a regular quarterly survey job collection process that feeds the Bureau of National Bureau of Labor Statistics process. And it is a much, instead of a random survey of businesses, which the monthly numbers are, it is a full survey of 150,000 businesses. So it is part of a regular data collection process. It is a bigger sample. It's likely to be more accurate. Those things are true.
Back to the phones. Patrick in Brookfield is with us next. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So when I see these numbers, I was wondering if there's a comparison, if we could look at this comparison from a perspective of which of these set of numbers are generated from inside the state and which are generated from outside the state. In other words, if they're numbers that are being generated from inside the state are being done by academics that are potentially going to gain back their collective bargaining rights if Governor Walker loses in the recall. Could we hold those numbers suspect? Is that something we should consider?
What do you think, John Smart?
No, the statewide numbers come from the state's Department of Bureau, I forget what it's called, the Bureau of Labor something or other. Workforce development, it's called, and that comes from the state government. And those people are, after all, Walker appointees. The figures that most people use are the ones that come from the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics. And as I said before, that's the one that 49 of the 50 states are using on a regular basis. And we used to use that here in Wisconsin, too, until Scott Walker found out that they were not complimentary.
Before we wrap up on this jobs numbers issue, this is what Democrats, Mayor Barrett in particular, have been stressing a lot in the last couple of weeks, hitting these bad job numbers. A lot of the buzz online from supporters of Governor Walker with the release of these quarterly numbers is, well, that's it for that. The job issue is no longer important. We're seeing some gains when we look at, well, apparently these more accurate numbers. In the next few weeks now, up to the election, are the job numbers still going to be a big issue, Keene?
Well, first of all, I'm just going to back up and sort of debunk both the last speakers a little bit. I don't think there's a bias in the collection of these numbers. They are collected by civil service employees in the Department of Workforce Development. They are a part of a collection process that feeds the data to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. It's a standardized process that's used in many states. The notion that it's Walker people or it's leftist academics really doesn't enter into it. It is an established process that feeds the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. So, and I now I got to go back to your question, which I forgot.
That's okay. Oh, it was a brilliant question too. Now, will do these positive job numbers that the governor's office that they've released, is that going to blunt the impact of Democrats pointing to the negative job numbers, or is this still going to be the back and forth between now and Election Day?
I think there'll be a back and forth, but people have to understand you live by the sword, you die by the sword, and so both sides have, I think, elevated the job numbers to an unrealistic level, and somebody's going to get lucky and somebody's not.
John?
I would pretty much agree with that. I'd have no idea what's going to happen. And again, these kinds of figures that we're throwing around here, it's sort of in the eye of the beholder. You know, you can pretty much, like statistics and polls, as I said before, you can kind of play them the way you want to say whatever it is you want them to say.
We'll get into some of the polls after the break that's coming up, but a related issue that was in the news this week and the week before, the discussion over this right-to-work legislation. Governor Walker said he won't push for that legislation. Some Republican representatives have said that, or they've said recently that they had drafted some right-to-work legislation, but the time wasn't right in the past or certainly in the present to introduce it. Democrats are, in some cases, unions are waving this around as an issue, saying, hey, give them the chance. They're going to hit us with right-to-work legislation that they see as an attack on private employee unions as opposed to public employee unions. Much ado about nothing, Keene Winters, or should we be talking about right-to-work?
I think it's a fair discussion to have, and it's a fair discussion to have that in the laboratory of democracies, most states are right-to-work states. And if I'm looking at that ad in The Economist magazine where Indiana is touting we are right-to-work and you ought to locate businesses here, and that, in fact, is having an impact, then it's something we certainly should consider.
John Smart, are you worried about right-to-work?
Yes, I am. And I would question the governor's sincerity in this regard because he, after all, when he was in the state legislature, proposed right-to-work legislation at that time. Let me also point out that right-to-work is a very strange misnomer for this particular activity. What it is essentially is a way of union busting. I think everybody recognizes that, and Indiana is certainly a good example of that. But yeah, I don't trust this governor to as he says, he's not going to support it or he's not going to promote it or whatever, and I don't believe that.
We'll bring Dan in Three Lakes in on this issue. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. I'm just calling to point out that in yesterday's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on this topic, among others, there was an article about the 2012 first quarter credibility consumer distress index by states, state by state, and it ranks households as to how they feel comfortable with their financial condition. For openers, Indiana is six from the bottom. Indiana is in 44th place. There is only one right-to-work state in the top 10. That's Iowa. In the bottom 10, there six of the bottom 10 are right-to-work states in the South: Alabama, South Carolina, Tennessee, Florida, Mississippi, and Georgia. And Indiana is at 44th place.
Gotcha. Keene, what do you think about what Dan had to say?
Well, I think it's interesting, and I think it's worth having a debate about how we want our institutions to work. I could posit out there for you that right to work would be good for unions in the sense that it would force them to be more cognizant of serving their members and less likely to just simply take for granted the closed shop, gather up all the cash, and enter into the political process. I would like to see unions be more responsive to their members. And I think if they did, the net result of that might be that union membership actually grows. But the preoccupation of unions right now with politics lets them be – and this comes – you know, I spent a lot of time in the JC organization asking people to pay membership dues to come and volunteer. And they'd say, why should I do – you know, we'll pay to volunteer. But we had to serve our members or they didn't join. And I think that's healthy for any organization. In the kinds of statistics your caller has brought up, I think we should have a fair and open debate about that. And I think it's certainly worth considering. And we should be somewhat deferential to the fact that most states have come down on the right to work side.
Before you respond, John Smart, let's bring in Randy and Kowaskum. Hi, Randy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I hear a lot about the right to work and, you know, the demonization by people like John Smart. But what I don't hear much about is how the national unions and the Obama administration are pushing card check, which is a nasty thing where unions get to go out and twist people's arm and get them to sign the card. And once they have 50% of the workers in a shop sign the card, you have the union, like it or not. There's no more secret ballot. And this is being touted as being wonderful and good for the people. These national unions have gotten so powerful, they aren't out for the workers' rights. They're out for their own benefit.
John Smart, I'll let your response to Randy close up on this issue.
Well, I think saying that unions have gotten so big and powerful is kind of belies history. Unions are probably at one of their lowest ebbs in American recent history. They're not big and powerful at all anymore. And I think that that's kind of crazy. As far as the card check and as opposed to secret ballots, that's a case-by-case basis. Some places they do it, some places they don't. And I just don't think that's an issue.
You're listening to John Smart and Keene Winters. This is the Week in Review. We'll move on now past right to work and jobs numbers to some new poll numbers in Wisconsin's recall election after the break. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Carnine this morning. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Carnine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 11, Larry Mueller looks at how to grow roses in a northern climate like, say, Wisconsin's. Be a successful rose gardener after 11. This hour, it's the Week in Review. I'm talking to John Smart and Keene Winters. And speaking of roses, some rosy poll numbers for Governor Walker. The Marquette poll, the Marquette Law School poll, run by frequent guest here, Charles Franklin. Recent polls he's done have shown kind of neck and neck, very close races. His newest one, about a 5-point lead for Governor Walker, consistent with some other polls that have been out lately. John Smart, what do you think of the poll numbers? You getting worried?
No. And as I said before, poll numbers, anybody can kind of make them up as they go along, really. There are so many different ones. There's an interesting poll from Frederick Yang, for instance, showing Barrett ahead, and in specific circumstances, asking about likability and things like that. One shows, bringing people together. Who's most capable of bringing people together? 42% for Barrett, 32% for Walker. I mean, as I said, these polls, and there are hundreds of them, and we could listen to whichever ones we want to, but I have to point out the fact that the polls seem to be representing, one, the fact that Walker and company are spending considerably more money than the Barrett side of this equation, as we can tell by turning on our television sets. And I think that that's going to have some effect. And in fact, I'm surprised it doesn't have more effect. But it just seems like that Scott Walker seems to have reached a kind of a 50% level, and he can't get past it, no matter how much money they spend. And I think that that's kind of a concern on their side.
Keene Winters, are you happy to see these poll numbers, or are you as skeptical in your own way as John Smart is?
I'm always skeptical of polls. I mean, they can change. But I do, I think from being involved in the campaign, you have a sense of where the momentum is going. And I think these polls are reflective of that. I think Scott Walker is going to come out. There's going to be a six-point spread, so maybe 47-53, that's going to hold. And my sort of informal barometer is who is winning the sign war. And I've had a chance to make the trip to Appleton, the trip to Marshfield, and by far and away the Walker people are winning the sign war, except if I get into maybe downtown Madison. I've even had some friends tell me he's winning the sign war in Milwaukee. And it may seem silly, but putting up a yard sign is a very personal decision. You're displaying something for your neighbors. And so I always, when I'm working in campaigns, I have a special spot for the yard sign people. And I think Walker's winning the yard sign war, and that's going to hold up.
John Smart, whether we're talking about signs or less tangible measures of enthusiasm, is that sort of undefinable momentum on Governor Walker's side here?
No, I don't think so. I keep in mind that, as I said before, Governor Walker is spending, there depends on how you look at it, but people have said as much as five times as much, or maybe even more than that, as the Barrett side. Also, the fact that the Democrats had a primary, and so the Barrett signs are actually still coming out. I've got a bunch of Barrett signs going to be showing up here in Price County today, sometime, that were being driven up from Stoughton. So we're kind of behind, as you might say, in getting out there. But also there's the fact that, as I said, the other side has got an awful lot more money than we have to buy signs and to buy everything else.
Speaking of money, there's been some criticism from the group MoveOn.org, among others, that the National Democratic Party, the DNC, hasn't put the money where their mouth is to support the recall effort. Does that mean they think it's a lost cause, do you think, John?
No, I don't. As a matter of fact, and I think that has been overplayed considerably. Wendy Wasserman Schultz is going to be in Wisconsin, I think, this weekend, sometime, I'm not sure, to do a fundraiser for Mayor Tom. And I'm sure that she's the national chairman of the Democratic Party, and I have no doubt that they will be supplying whatever assistance they can. They already are, as is the Democratic Governors Association and a few other organizations. But we're never going to come up with the millions that the Walker side has gotten. And Scott Walker has made it a campaign all across the country to get wealthy Republican donors to give him money. 60% or 70% of his money, the funds in his campaign, have come from out of state, which tells us something, doesn't it?
Keene, John is pointing out of state money behind the governor. Should we lay awake at night worrying about that?
I don't think so. I think you have a lot of out of state money. I think people are going to say to Tammy Baldwin, you have a lot of out of state money. I think people say that all the time. But in a larger sense, there is a reluctance on the national level, because I think the strategy of going for all for nothing and going outside the regular electoral process and going for broke is not sitting well with people. People are tired of the recalls. Walker's got more money. He's got signs. People are tired of this process. They would rather go back to the regular process. And those things are beginning to add up and weigh on the Barrett campaign. And you can try and make it rosy, but I think it was a bad strategy that really the Democrats should have used the determination of their people to take this issue on cycle after cycle after cycle, and essentially, pardon the pun, eat the elephant one bite at a time. And that this go for broke strategy is the national people are worried about it because it's going to affect Obama. It was not a good strategy, and it's not sitting well with people.
One last quick campaign tactical question. Democrats, one of their big talking points this last week, hammering away at that John Doe probe. It involved some of Governor Walker's employees when he was county executive. To all indications, has not been directly implicated in anything, but Democrats are trying to raise questions about his involvement, his hiring of the people involved, his legal defense fund. Is this going to hurt Governor Walker, Keene Winters, or is this a desperation tactic, as some Republican strategists are saying?
Well, I do think it's somewhat overblown, but you know it always has the potential to hurt. I will tell you, on a personal level, employees should not be using government property to engage in campaigns. So in 2006, I worked on a campaign, and our Democratic opponent, a school teacher, was designing literature on a school computer, running it off in the industrial arts room. We caught him. He got a 3-day suspension, which was later revoked. You know, I think he should have lost his job for that. And so what these people did is wrong, but it happens all everybody knows that employees not only do this, but they surf the internet, they engage in emails, in to the sense that some mid-level people engaging in misusing the internet at work, or misusing emails at work, sort of is Scott Walker's fault, I think is a stretch, and it's going to prove to be a stretch. But I don't condone what they did, but it happens all the time.
John Smart?
Well, I think that this was happening in the office adjacent to Scott Walker's office. I think he must have had some kind of a notion of what was going on. But a point that I would like to emphasize is that Scott Walker has set up this legal defense fund. Now, according to state law, he is not allowed to do that unless he is under investigation. And he had to get approval to set up that legal defense fund from the Government Accountability Board. So presumably, he is under investigation, or at least he persuaded the GAB that he's under investigation. Otherwise, his legal defense fund is an illegal enterprise.
Now, we'll wrap up the recall issue with this question. I'm going to ask each of you in turn to contemplate failure. John Smart, what happens if the Democrats lose, if Tom Barrett loses this recall election? What do state Democrats do to rebuild after that?
Recoup. And but we're really concerned about this because Scott Walker has done, I think, serious damage to the state when he's been under the gun. And if he is freed by another election to do what he pleases, and if we don't manage to change the legislature, then I think we're really in serious trouble. But I'm not discounting the possibility of changing the legislature either. I think that that's very likely going to happen. But I can see that there could be a serious problem if indeed it ends up going back to what we had before with Scott Walker as governor and Republicans in control of the legislature. I think we're really in for serious trouble. And we were talking before about right-to-work laws and things like that. I think that's just the beginning.
Keene Winters, same question, but the mirror image. What do Republicans do in the event of Scott Walker losing the recall election?
I think that's a very good question, and I have real misgivings about how we will resolve that. I think the question is, if these recalls succeed, is the lesson that we learn or take from it, and I'm not sure it's the lesson we should learn, is that this is a successful tactic, and we should now, if the Democrats decide to go nuclear, we should respond in kind with our own round of recalls. And so if recalls succeed, I think there's going to be a temptation for that to spawn another round of recalls. I actually hope that doesn't happen, but I can see it happening, and it would really be dysfunctional for the state. I think the best thing that can happen for all of us is that the recall process fails and that we go back to resolving our disputes, even though we still have them, through a regular process.
Or maybe we could just go to biennial elections for governor. Nobody's thrown that idea out there, as far as I know. I'm joking.
Well, but Rob, you know, until the early 1930s, there was in fact biennial.
Oh, no kidding.
Governors were elected for a 2-year term, and so when the recall process was contemplated, it never affected governors because you can't, you've got to have a person in a year in office, and you might as well just wait for, so people with 2 year terms don't get recalled, because by the time you can recall them, it's a regular election.
Sure.
So it was never contemplated that these recalls would be used against a governor, and they were just simply not eligible till the term was switched to 4 years.
I'd also like to point out the fact that the only recent other governor recall election was held was in California, and when Gray Davis was recalled, which gave us the dubious distinction of getting Arnold Schwarzenegger on the national stage. But that has not engendered more recall elections in California. They certainly are. They feel like they learned their lesson, I think, and they don't want to do it anymore.
I want to turn, before we go to national news, the other big state election this year, the race for the U.S. Senate. The Republican Party state convention convened last weekend, and nobody from among the four Republican primary contenders for Senate ended up getting the endorsement. Jeff Fitzgerald ended up coming out ahead in votes over Eric Hovde, Tommy Thompson, and Mark Newman. What do you make of that, Keene Winters?
Well, I think I'm glad there was no endorsement. I think it's dicey for the party to weigh in before there is a primary. We learned that lesson in the Lee Dreyfus, Bob Caston era, if anybody remembers back that far. But I also think I take the results with a grain of salt. The Newman people worked very, very hard to pack people into the convention, and so they did moderately well. They were really the second place. Jeff Fitzgerald's organization, at least at the convention, has a special ability in the fact that they have state assembly people in virtually every county delegation, and those would be respected members of those delegations. They have a little extra pull there. Eric Hovde, I think he runs a very, very good campaign, you know, but it's hard to go from man on the street to member of the Senate like Ron Johnson did with name recognition. I think he has a lot of potential and could still do very well at the polls. I'm not so sure the news was as good for the Thompson campaign. And I think that the lesson for them might be they need to do more boots on the ground and be less reliant on celebrity. And maybe that's a good lesson for them to learn at this point while they still can.
John Smart, quick thoughts on the Senate primary in the Republican Party?
Yeah, the one that comes to mind, of course, is Tommy Thompson. And I think it's indicative of what's happening with the Republican Party nationwide. Last week, Dick Lugar also got bounced in Indiana, one of the most respected members of the U.S. Senate. And Tommy Thompson, there was a time when he could have been elected king, I think, in Wisconsin. And now his own party is essentially rejecting him, which I think is very interesting, because I keep looking back at Republicans of the past who would not even be allowed in the door anymore. I mean, I spent a lot of time living in New York State, and I remember voting for Nelson Rockefeller for governor and Jacob Javits for the Senate and John Lindsay for the Congress, and they were Republicans. But those Republicans would be drummed out of the party today, and that's, I think, what's happening to Tommy Thompson.
National issues coming up, and of course, the Week in Review quiz. This is the Week in Review. Guests John Smart and Keene Winters. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret here, filling in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network. Coming after 9, you'll hear Veronica Rickert talking to psychologist Steven Pinker. He makes the case that the world is becoming a less violent place. Find out why coming up after 9. This hour, it's the Week in Review. I'm talking to John Smart and Keene Winters about the top state and national news of the week, coming up on National News Now. But first, this week's Week in Review quiz. This week, researchers came out with a study showing a correlation between drinking a certain beverage and up to a 10% lower risk of death. The question, what is that beverage? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, if you think you know the answer or just want to take a guess, or email talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Give the answer and hopefully a lucky winner in about 10 minutes. National news, the lesson from the J.P. Morgan Bank punting about $2 billion. President Obama says the lesson is we need to get those bank regulations in gear. We passed a law a couple of years ago requiring rules to be made. They are not all in place yet. The Romney campaign says, no, we don't want to overregulate banks. Too much regulation is part of our problem here. Let's start with John Smart on this one. Banks, more or less regulation?
I think more regulation. And I think that the serious problem that we're dealing with in all of that is the fact that Glass-Steagall, the bill that was put in place back in the 30s, was thrown out 10 or 15 years ago. And I think that a whole lot of the problems that we're dealing with now on Wall Street came about because of that. Glass-Steagall set the rules so that a bank could be a bank and an investment company would be an investment company, and they wouldn't cross over each other's lines. And I think that we were a lot better off at that point. Romney, of course, would say that, you know, no regulation. He thinks that Wall Street should be able to basically do as it pleases. But I think that this is seriously damaging. I think it's interesting that they're saying J.P. Morgan lost $2, maybe $3 billion, but it's not going to hurt any of their people who have put money into it. Well, it seems to me it's got to hurt somebody. Where's that money coming from, for heaven's sakes? They don't seem to talk about that.
Keen Winters?
Well, it does hurt J.P. Morgan's shareholders. So there is someone who is getting hurt, and it was their money. I actually agree with John in the sense that I think revisiting Glass-Steagall, and particularly the notion that we should divide banking and investment banking. But my sense is that Mitt Romney is the guy to do that in the same way that Teddy Roosevelt was the guy to break the trusts up. That coming to the conclusion on this side that competition is important, and that having banks that are too big to fail and are backstopped by the government is not a good idea. That those risky parts of their business should be free to float free and fail free and not take down the rest of the system. But I would disagree with John's characterization that we need more regulation. So Frank Dodd represents more regulation, and that's the Obama's response to essentially micromanage the process. That's really killing us at the community bank level, where it's creating more paperwork for an organization, community banks, which really weren't part of the mortgage debacle in any significant way, but they have to do lots of training, lots of forms, and it's you're not going to have bigger government and more regulation and micromanagement of the process. What you really need to do is have what I agree with, John, is a divorce between investment banking and banking, which is about the money supply.
Now, are banks going to be a political issue between President Obama and Mitt Romney in the coming months, or is this kind of a snoozer for voters, do you think? John Smart first.
I think that probably most voters are not following this one very closely, because I think it's just kind of an arcane subject, and most people don't really understand the difference between a full-service bank and an investment bank and so forth and so on. But I think that people are kind of rattled by the idea that a company, a bank like J.P. Morgan Chase, could lose between $2 and $3 billion and say, oh, gee, that was pretty dumb, wasn't it? We shouldn't have done that. I think we need more than that.
Keem?
Well, I hope we do have a healthy debate about it, and maybe I'll start it right here. And that is, when you think about banking, it is about the money supply. A bank is a place where I can take my money till I need it, or I can go to get a loan. And if the banking system fails, your economy fails, because people don't have access to either the money they saved or access to loans. And that's why we have federal insurance for the banking system. Investment banking is another animal. It's about taking risk. It's about entrepreneurship. And they ought to be free to take risks, but they also ought to be free to fail so that the best ideas win and that bad ideas aren't backstopped by the government. So there should be a divorce between those two. And I think I see bits and pieces of that in the political process. I see in Eric Hovde talking about the difficulties in Wall Street. I see people in the Tea Party who are unhappy with bailouts, and I would in general agree with them. But I would also say you have to understand that the banking system has to not fail. And so bailouts of the banks, but the money going to the investment banks part is problematic. And so we should have a debate, because I think the pieces are out there. We just not have not put them in the way together in the way that Teddy Roosevelt put together the discussion about trust at the turn of the century.
Now, I framed that question as part of the presidential race. Sticking with that topic, that Marquette Law School poll we mentioned earlier saw Mitt Romney making strides in Wisconsin. He was losing in previous polls, looks much closer, virtually tied in the latest poll. Now, notwithstanding your reservations about taking polls too seriously, both of you, is Wisconsin a contested state, do you think? Will candidates be paying attention to Wisconsin in this presidential election? Keen first.
I think they'll be paying to, certainly Wisconsin is a swing state in the process. And so have to know that people will be paying attention. It will be very difficult for Obama to get the electoral math without getting Wisconsin, so it'll be an important state. That all being said, I would have to venture a guess, that the current poll numbers out there are pretty soft. There is a whole notion in political spheres in Wisconsin, nothing matters until after June 5th. All hands are on deck for the recall elections. Mm-hmm. And so that regular events for someone just running for the assembly in November, those things are sort of on hold. And so how strong those numbers are, I think people's attention is elsewhere.
John, Wisconsin, a swing state in the fall?
Oh, yes, definitely. And I think, again, as I said before, the whole nation is essentially watching Wisconsin. And Keene is right as far as the attention being on the recall. And I think that everybody is going to be watching us, and that's going to determine how the campaigns, the national campaigns, decide to treat Wisconsin. But I definitely think that, yeah, we're a swing state and we're an important one. And since we have the attention of the country, I think that's going to continue.
Here's another national issue in the news this week, a bit of deja vu. Remember all those battles over the debt ceiling and the games of chicken? We might see that again. House Speaker John Boehner said this week, not going to pass a debt ceiling increase without some substantial spending cuts from the White House. Republicans saying that military cuts and tax increases are pretty much off the table. Is this ever going to go away, John Smart? Are we going to be arguing about the debt ceiling every 3-4 months?
As long as the situation is like it is, yes, we are. The debt ceiling increases, by the way, there were many more of them during the Bush years than there have been recently. But then they were kind of an automatic thing, and nobody paid that much attention to it. But now, of course, they do, because they want to turn it into a campaign issue. But it's going to continue, no question about it.
Keene Winters?
Well, I would start by saying that during the Bush administration, the national debt was solidly 20%. National budget was actually 20% of GDP. Under the Obama administration, it's become 24% of GDP. In the deficits, the $1 trillion deficits are bigger. So there is fair reason, to be more concerned about it now than we were 10 years ago. And so I think that's important. I worry that this is going to become a game of political chicken. I'm a financial planner. It's awful to go through another downgrade like this. I do see a glimmer of hope, in the sense that the one thing that Speaker Boehner has put on the table is modification of the tax code, which would eliminate loopholes, and he would agree to that, meaning that some people who've lost their loopholes would in fact be paying more taxes. He just doesn't want to change the tax rate. And I hope Obama takes him up on this. I just don't think he will. I don't think President Obama is ever he's in constant campaign mode, and he's never in governing mode. And we haven't seen him in governing mode offering compromises. And here's a little one that would be really, really great if he would agree to do it that way.
Turning to another big money issue, Facebook, a big release of stock today, I believe, billions of dollars in the works, concerns about how the valuation of Facebook as a company. You're a financial planner, Keene Winters. I won't ask for a stock picking tip from you, maybe after the show. What do you think? Is this a big deal, this Facebook offering?
Well, it's certainly a big deal. It's an exciting deal. It's certainly mammoth by its numbers. It has all sorts of dimensions that you can have someone who is the age of Mark Zuckerberg actually put together something out on the internet and become really one of the richest men in the world overnight. That is unprecedented. We live in unprecedented times where something like five or six of the world's largest 30 market cap companies didn't exist in 1975. That's never been true. It talks about, speaks to the pace of change that's out there. What leaves us is questions on how to evaluate this. Where is the revenue stream going to come from to support this stock price? And those of us who remember the tech bubble and how great it was and everything was going to be cool out on the internet realized that unless a business had an income stream, it was going to fail. And I think Facebook is here to stay, whether it has the revenue stream in the future and whether it has the management talent to be good in the future. I open questions.
John Smart, I've seen a poll this week saying about half of Americans think Facebook might be a fad. I know you are on Facebook. Is it a fad, or is this going to be a fixture of the American economy and personal lives for years to come?
I don't know. I remember when I thought Yahoo was the bee's knees, as we used to say. No, I think that probably all these things have a definite life. I, too, am concerned, as Keen is, about where is this revenue stream coming from? Where are they getting the money, other than selling stock on the block? But I'm not sure about that. I don't know where they're getting it.
I'm going to reveal this week's quiz winner. The question was, researchers came out with a study showing a correlation between drinking a certain beverage and a substantial lower risk of death. The question was, what is that beverage? Jackie in Brookfield had one of the correct answers and was chosen at random from the correct winners. She'll win a prize. The answer, and I'm happy about this, it's coffee. Won't go through all the details, but the gist is coffee drinking was correlated with a pretty substantial decrease in death risk. And the scientists, and I got to say a lot of the reporters, were careful to point out correlation is not causation. That doesn't mean coffee makes you live longer. Oh, by the way, it didn't matter if it was decaf or regular. John and Keen. John first. Good news. Are you drinking coffee during the show?
Absolutely. And I was glad to see that it doesn't matter whether it's caffeinated or decaffeinated, because I usually drink decaf.
Why?
I'm glad that it wasn't the caffeine that was going to make me live longer.
Well, what's the point? Us early morning radio people would not do it without the caffeine.
Well, I can understand that. In fact, if I have time in the morning, I'll brew a pot of regular first, drink that, and then brew a pot of decaffeinated. Decaffeinated for later on in the morning or the afternoon.
Keen Winters, coffee drinker?
It's bad news for me. I'm not a coffee drinker. I have water here with me in the studio this morning.
I've heard that there are some health benefits to regular consumption of water.
Okay, that's good to know.
Well, I think that's all the time we have in the week in review. John Smart, any big plans for the weekend?
No, I don't think so. We're kind of enjoying spring again up here in the Northwest.
Spring part two.
Yeah, spring part two. And thank you, Rob. You did a very good job. I like it.
Thanks. Keen Winters, your weekend plans?
Well, I'm hoping to kickstart an assembly campaign here and for someone else, not for me, here in Wausau. And we got to start thinking about the November elections too soon.
We'll be thinking about that in the coming months. Thanks to both of you for joining the show today.
Can I add a plug?
Plug away.
I'm going over tomorrow to Chippewa Falls for Fighting Bob Fest North.
They're having those all year this time of year. All right, thanks to John Smart and Keen Winters. John Smart, chair of the Price County Democratic Party, board member for Wisconsin Alliance for Excellent Schools. He serves on the board of the United Nations Association of Wisconsin. Keen Winters, financial planner in Schofield. He's coordinator of the Center-Right Coalition of Wausau. Thanks to Amanda Magnus and to Cynthia Schuster and to Glenn Moberg for production this morning. I'm Rob Ferret. I'm filling in for Joy Cardine. Joy will be back on Monday, by the way. Don't miss the State Capitol Report after 7. We'll kick off our series of candidate forums in the Senate recall races, 7 to 8. Watch for it all week. Rob Ferret filling in for Joy Cardine. Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.